That would be the Nabati, I hope I'm pronouncing that, I'm not.
Your guess is good as mine.
I'm sure I've got it wrong, I usually do. Appellant has waived argument, so if you'd like to proceed.
Sure, thank you.
Thank you.
Please the court, Christianaville for the Commonwealth as the appellee in this appeal. Mr. Nabati has raised two assignments of error in his brief. The first is an argument that the trial court erred in admitting certain statements he made to a police officer in the hospital. And despite the fact that Mr. Nabati, in his case in chief, testified and testified about those same statements, thereby the Commonwealth's argument would be thereby waiving the earlier objection under this court's published case law. In the second assignment of error, Mr. Nabati argues that the evidence was insufficient to prove that he was criminally negligent, despite the fact that he admitted to a magistrate that he was high at the time of the offenses, and despite the fact that the evidence proved that he swerved his vehicle completely into the path of an oncoming car and did not make any attempt to stop that vehicle before the collision occurred. So this Commonwealth would argue that this court should affirm his conviction despite both assignments of error. As to the first assignment of error, I'd like to submit, we argued on brief that the, even assuming there is error, that error is harmless. And I'd like to put before the court an additional kind of layer of that argument, which is that it's harmless because it was waived, or it was waived because therefore it's harmless. Because by testifying in his case in chief about the same statements that he made to that police officer, he introduced substantially the same evidence into the record. So even if this court were to hold that the trial court did err not suppressing those statements that were introduced in the Commonwealth's case, the court would still be left with a record that contains the statements that came in through his own case in chief, through his own testimony. And therefore, any error must be harmless. And I'd like to submit two cases for the court's consideration. And I'll give you the case sites since they were not cited on brief. But the first case is Isaac versus Commonwealth. That case was decided in 2011 and authored by then Judge Kelsey. It's at 58 VA App 255. The second case is Bynum versus Commonwealth, B-Y-N-U-M. That's at 28 VA App 451. And that was authored by then Judge Lemons in 1998. Both of those cases dealt with this concept of a defendant or a party introducing evidence that he'd earlier objected to and thereby waiving any earlier objection. In the Isaac case, the objection was to a BAC certificate of analysis that showed that the defendant's BAC was a 0.16. And so there's an objection made. The trial court initially sustained the objection, but eventually reversed course and allowed in that evidence. And then when the defendant began to put on the defendant's case, the defendant introduced a different certificate of analysis that showed a 0.14 BAC. And the argument was that because of the inconsistency, neither of the BAC certificates were reliable. And an opinion authored by then-Judge Kelsey, this court, a published opinion, held that by introducing substantially similar evidence in his own case in chief, the defendant had waived that earlier objection, thereby rendering any error harmless, and the court declined to reach the ultimate issue in that case. We would submit that holding is controlling of the outcome here, and that the defendant waived his objection. Bynum stands for the same proposition. In Bynum, the facts were actually quite similar to the facts here. There is a constitutional objection to statements that were introduced over an objection that the Miranda warning should have been given, and the defendant was in custody when he was questioned. And the Court of Appeals, in a published opinion in Bynum, held that because the defendant took the stand and testified about those statements that he had made that he had earlier objected to, he testified to the substance of those statements, that he had waived that objection, thereby rendering any error harmless. So we would submit that those two cases are controlling the outcome.
In this case, when he was in the hospital, he said he was going 50, 55, 58.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that he couldn't recall anything about the accident. When he testified, did he estimate his speed?
He estimated his speed to be 45, 50, 45, 50, somewhere in there. I think those were his words. So there is some small discrepancy between the speeds that he gave to the officer in the hospital and the speed that he testified to at trial. And I think then-Judge Kelsey's opinion in Isaac's is your commentary on what to do with that small discrepancy. And what he held there was it doesn't have to be the exact same testimony or the exact same evidence as long as it is of a substantially similar character. Of course, there the difference was between a 0.14 and a 0.16. And the court in that opinion held that it was still waived.
And the other thing he said in the hospital was about the last time that he took Suboxone was at the day before. Is that right?
I believe that is correct, yes, sir.
And that he took the amitriptyline, and I'm sure I'm not saying that right, at 7 o'clock that morning.
In his testimony, he testified that even though he had told the officer during the statement that he had been on amitriptyline, and I'm guessing too, that he actually had not begun taking that drug yet. That was his explanation for it at trial. And what this court, and again, and Isaac explained in that opinion, is that when the defendant takes the stand and introduces substantially similar evidence and then makes some effort to explain it away or to just cast it in a different light, he's still waiving that earlier objection, even though he paints it in a different light. So I would submit that the case is controlling that first assignment of error. On the merits of the argument, I know we've argued the Nixon case, which is an unpublished opinion by this court, and of course persuasive but not binding. I would also just submit for the court's consideration a Fourth Circuit case decided in 2011, which is United States versus Jameson, and that's at 509 F3rd 623. In Jameson, the court there is a hospital interview of a what appeared to be a gunshot victim, and it turned out he had some culpability for the gunshot wound that he himself sustained. And what the Fourth Circuit said in Jameson is similar to what this court said in Nixon in the unpublished opinion, which is that when you're looking at whether a defendant is in custody during statements that were made, you look at restraints imposed by the police and not restraints that are the natural consequence of the fact that the person's
Counsel,
in the hospital.
Really quickly, reference to Nixon, which I know is not binding, is slightly factually different than the facts of this case where there was actually a summons given. It has to be looked at as something more tantamount to an arrest as opposed to in Nixon where they were going and questioning her, and there was no other restraint other than the fact that she was in the hospital.
Well, I think that the summons could cut both ways. It could cut the way that you suggested. It could also indicate to the defendant that this is your summons. This is when I'll need you to appear in court based on what we've discussed so far. And therefore, the next line of questioning is not questioning about suspecting you of committing a certain offense. It's not some sort of interrogation. We've already dealt with that part of the interview. And so at that point, a reasonable person could feel free to think to himself, I've already dealt with, you know, I have to appear in court for what I've done, but now I can ask the officer I'd really like to terminate this conversation. And so I think the light most favorable of the Commonwealth that the summons actually cuts in favor of the argument that he was not in custody and not the other way around. But I would submit this court is required to decide case on the merits of best grounds, and the court is well aware. And I think the argument that he waived any objection is the strongest and the clearest argument for sustaining the conviction in this case by introducing substantially the same evidence in his own case in chief. As to the second assignment of error, the sufficiency argument, I think that, again, this case is controlled by prior Virginia case law. And I'll submit that the case that is the most factually similar and most on point, and I'll give the court the citation, I apologize, it's not in our brief, the case is Zirkle versus Commonwealth, Z-I-R-K-L-E. And Zirkle is cited in Wyatt, which I noticed was mentioned in the prior argument this morning, right before I got up here. But Zirkle is a case decided by the Supreme Court of Virginia in 1949. It's at 189 VA 862. As I said, the facts in that case are very similar to the facts here. The defendant was convicted of involuntary manslaughter in that case. The facts were that there was some evidence in the record that he had been drinking, although he contested the evidence that he had been drinking, said he had not been drinking. The facts showed that the defendant swerved his vehicle across the center line and right in front of oncoming traffic just before the accident occurred, and showed that he made no attempt to swerve back into his lane before the accident occurred. And the Supreme Court of Virginia in Zirkle held, based on those facts, the evidence was sufficient to prove that he was criminally negligent in driving his vehicle in that manner. And of course, in this case, the facts are almost very close to identical, although you'll never get a perfectly identical case, but very close, in that there is evidence that the defendant was high, based on his own statement to the magistrate that he was high at the time of the accident. And of course, there was evidence that his vehicle swerved completely into the lane of oncoming traffic, based on the witness's testimony that both headlights disappeared. And then there's no evidence that he made any attempt to stop before the accident occurred. You had testimony from the trooper that there were no pre-incident skid marks on the roadway. So those facts make this case very similar to Zirkle and therefore make Zirkle controlling. I will say the court ultimately reversed in Zirkle on different grounds, but before getting that part of the court's opinion, the court did hold that the evidence was sufficient to prove criminal negligence. Sent the case back for a retrial, but the case is still good law for that principle. It's cited in this court's opinion in Wyatt versus Commonwealth, which is at 47 VAL 411, which is a 2006 published opinion, which has similar facts to Zirkle. There's a little more evidence of intoxication in Wyatt than there was in Zirkle. But I do think Zirkle is controlling of the sufficiency argument. In addition to the evidence that is similar to the evidence in Zirkle, we also have the defendant's testimony. And he testified that the car was in his own lane, and that's why he attempted to swerve one way and then swerve the other way. Of course, the jury was entitled to do one of two things with that testimony, either to disbelieve the testimony and conclude that he was lying because he realized that he was guilty, which constitutes affirmative evidence of his guilt under Black versus Commonwealth, or the jury could have concluded that he really did believe there was a car in his lane, but based on the other witness's testimony, there was no car in his lane, and thus his intoxication, his taking these prescription medicines inappropriately, and his being high by his own admission, caused him to misread the facts, the roadway, and whether or not there was actually a vehicle in front of him. Either reading supports a conclusion that he was guilty and the evidence was sufficient.
Counsel, remind me, it's been a long morning, remind me, did he testify that he was high? I know he told the magistrate that he was high, but of course that was after he'd been wandering around in the wilderness, allegedly, for 2 days, and everybody was looking for him. Did he testify to when he, at trial that he was high?
He did not testify at trial that he was high. He tried to testify that he hadn't taken the medicines that morning or the day before.
And of course, as you have indicated earlier, the toxicology report showed no evidence of.
The toxicology report is important because it showed no evidence of amitriptyline in the system.
Okay.
However, what the lab technician testified is that the other drug that he admitted he had been taking, they didn't have procedures to be able to test for that drug. So
but
there may have been that drug in his system at the time of the offense. And we would argue that, like Mr. of the Commonwealth, his admission that he was high, plus his statement to the officer who was acting as a fireman at the time and removing him from the vehicle, telling that individual, I take 70 tests, that statement plus his later statement that he was high, and the fact that we just don't know from the toxicology report what was in his system as to that particular drug, we would argue that the evidence supports the conclusion that he was high on that particular drug. His statement to the magistrate asked about his driving on a suspended charge in particular. And it was in the context of that conversation that he said, I did it, I was high. He was charged with driving on a suspended license based on the driving behavior that led to the offense, the involuntary manslaughter. He was driving on a suspended license when he swerved in oncoming traffic and hit that oncoming vehicle. So we would submit that, like with favorable Commonwealth, the way to read his statement that he was high is that he was high at the time of that suspended license driving and high at the time of the involuntary manslaughter. The jury was certainly entitled to reject his later argument in his testimony that he was actually talking about being high sometime later. So for all of these reasons, unless there are further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on Commonwealth's brief and ask the court to affirm.
No, thank you. We'll come down and greet you.
Thank you.